Session number 22121, Reel 1.
Mr. Schofield, Reel 1, where were you born, please?
I was born in London.
Which year was this?
That was 1921.
You were telling me earlier that your father won the VC. Could you just repeat a little of what you told me earlier on, please?
Yes, my father, who was born in 1865, won his Victoria Cross at the Battle of Colenso in the Boer War. The actual battle was 1899. He was ADC to the General Buller at the time, and he won it with several other people. There was six, I think, VCs in all at that particular episode. Saving the Guns, who were in front of the line, and in those days it was considered the wrong thing, or not the right thing, that any gun should be left behind. And he was lucky enough to get away with it, and his team of two teams of horses saved two of the guns and brought them back to safety.
Which regiment did he belong to?
He was Royal Horse Artillery.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in London?
My first school was in London as a small boy, Mr. Gibbs's school, and then I went to St. Albans at Rotting Dean as a preparatory school, and then I was at Eton until 1939, where I was on the point of taking the Sandhurst exam to go into the army when it was all called off because the war had started.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
Yes, I heard that.
Under what circumstances?
Sorry?
Under what circumstances?
I can't remember, but I was all for declaring war after the invasion of Poland.
Did the war affect you at first?
Well, it affected me in as much that I was going to go to Sandhurst, and that was called off. And then I thought I was accepted for the Coldstream, and I thought I should be summoned straight away, but I had about a 6-month, 8-month gap before I was called up. And then I went to Caterham, where all raw recruits went. And I can remember arriving there in an old grey flannel suit, and they couldn't find a battle dress big enough for me because I'm 6'5", and I had to drill and do everything in my old grey flannel suit. And lots of other raw recruit guardsmen thought I was a reporter from the Daily Mirror and let on some terrible stories.
Had you particularly picked out the Coldstream Guards?
I was advised, and it just happened. I was interviewed and accepted.
What else happened to you at Caterham?
Well, then we went on a most ferocious course of drill, discipline, and physical training, and so on. And that lasted, I think, about 3 months. Weapon training, also every sort of infantry training, beginning at basics. And then I went to Sandhurst and was there for 6 months. And of my lot, I was given the equivalent of the Sword of Honour. And then from there, I was commissioned and went to Pirbright for a month or two, then to London for a month or two.
What happened at Pirbright?
Well, that was initiation into the regiment and further training. And as a second lieutenant supervising some of the training of the guardsmen that arrived there.
Were you happy at first with your introduction to
yes,
the regiment?
Yes, I was very happy the whole time. I was very happy.
And in London, what duties
did
you have?
They were guard duties, which was very boring.
What were you guarding?
We were guarding ammunition dumps and that sort of thing. And then at one stage down to Kenley Aerodrome, when the threat of German parachutists and the invasion, the German invasion, and I had a section of the perimeter guard with a platoon of guardsmen, two platoons of guardsmen. So we rigged up barbed wire and all sorts of snags that they could fall into if they did arrive. And of course it got bombed several times when we were there, which wasn't very pleasant.
Did you suffer any casualties?
No, we didn't suffer any casualties. We had slit trenches in which to dive, and luckily nobody was hurt at all.
Did the enemy inflict much damage at Kenley?
They did quite a lot. When I say there's no casualties, that's to my lot of people, my guardsmen. But of course there were casualties on the aerodrome with the RAF people. Yes, it did quite a bit of damage, but it was amazing how quickly runways were made good with bulldozers and so on. It hardly interrupted the activity, the RAF activity at all.
What did you think of the country's prospects in that summer of 1940?
What did I think of what?
What did you think of the country's prospects in the war in that summer?
Well, things were pretty grim, but I never had any doubt over the entire war that we would succeed in the end, although it had been a long, tough fight. And the kernel of the problem was to the bringing America into the war to help us, because we were there fighting completely alone. But luckily, our Air Force was absolutely brilliant in the Battle of Britain. And eventually the Germans decided not to continue with the intention of invading.
Were all your men at this stage regulars?
There were some regulars, but most of them had joined up since 39.
Which battalion were you with?
And then I went to the 4th Battalion, which at that time was down at Frome in the West Country, and I stayed with the 4th Battalion till the end of the war.
What battalion were you with at Kenley?
That was a holding battalion. We had, in peacetime, the Coldstream had three regular battalions, but they were built up during the war, and we had our 4th, 5th and 6th battalions. So we had 6 battalions actually fighting during the war.
What job were you given with the 4th battalion when you joined it at Frome?
Well, I was a platoon commander, and we were an infantry battalion, and then became a motorised infantry battalion in the Guards Armoured Division. And then it was 43, we were converted into an independent tank brigade with the 4th Battalion Grenadiers and 3rd Battalion Scots Guard out of the Guards Armoured Division. We were an independent tank brigade to be issued with Churchill tanks, which were the heaviest British tanks. They weighed 45 tons. And the early ones arrived and continuously blew up or caught fire. We had we had the Remy experts and men from Vauxhall Motors who built the tank down on every exercise, noting what was wrong and then putting it right. And by the time of Normandy, they were really good tanks. The only trouble with them was they were undergunned compared with the German. We had 6-pounder guns and 75mm guns taking on the German 88mm. But on the other hand, they were far better cross-country vehicles than either the German Tiger or the German Panther.
How had the battalion reacted to the news that you were to be converted from infantry to armour?
Excitement and worry would we be too big to get into tanks. But that proved ill-founded.
Why wasn't height more of a problem?
Well, it was a bit of a problem, but everybody other than the commander is sitting. The commander is standing up and standing out of the cupola, but it can close it down. Then it was rather cramped for a tall person like me. In fact, very cramped. But normally, going along, you had your head and shoulders outside the cupola.
Whereabouts in England did you do the training with the Churchill?
Well, we were down in off Salisbury Plain to begin with, and then we moved up to Yorkshire, Bellaby Moor, and joined up with the 15th Scottish Division, Infantry Division, who we did endless exercises with, and got to know each other extremely well. Troop commanders got to know platoon commanders and company commanders and so on all the way up. And it was with them we fought our first set-piece attack at the Battle of Caumont in late July 1944.
Any incidents that happened to you personally during the training period in England?
No, one loved to every now and again go on leave, 48 hours or 24-hour leave, and most of us made a dash to London and had took our girlfriends out.
Could London offer much during the
war?
Yes,
London was very amusing, and there were lots of places to go. Air raid sirens went every now and again, and people dived below ground. But on the whole, it was pretty good.
Whereabouts in Yorkshire is Bellaby Moor?
Bellaby Moor is south of Richmond.
What are your next memories?
Well, I can remember I had one rather tragic time up there when there was news that my younger brother, 2 years younger than me, who was a pilot in the RAF, was missing. And regrettably, he was never found. He was a pilot of Mosquito aircraft. And his training was in America, and having finished that, 2 squadrons of Mosquitoes went to Malta, and it was their first battle, and they were doing an offensive reconnaissance over Sicily, when they met, I was told, over 100 Messerschmitts, and every single one was shot down into the sea. So that was a sad moment, and particularly for my mother, who was alone, not knowing whether he was alive or dead.
That was in 1943, was it?
That was 1943, yes.
Did you do any training on amphibious landings?
Yes, a little later on. We moved from Bellaby Moor after quite a long period with the 15th Scottish Division down to the Dukeries in Nottinghamshire, where we stayed until we moved down to Kent about 2 months before D-Day. And the whole time we were training and getting fit and getting our wireless procedure excellent. And when we were in Kent, and just before D-Day and just after D-Day, because we didn't go over the Channel until July, we were taking part in this radio messages, one tank to another, put up on high hills with very big aerials, giving messages that the Germans would have heard to confuse them and make them believe that the attack was going to come in the Pas de Calais. That was quite interesting. And at that time, the V1s were coming over and right over us a lot of the time. And one, unfortunately, hit our brigade workshop and killed about 30% of our Remy experts.
Which place in Kent was that?
That was Charing.
Where were you at the time?
When that actually happened?
Yes.
I can't remember. I can't remember. The brigade workshop wasn't, as it were, in the next field. It was a mile or two away.
What happened next?
Well, do you mean about the Remy disaster?
Well, if there is anything more to add about that?
No, there's nothing more to add about that. We then moved down to... then D-Day happened, and we were all rather disappointed we weren't taking part in the D-Day operations, but heavy tanks weren't required in the early part, evidently. And we heard the news every day and got more and more impatient to get there. But we didn't, in fact, go over till the July, and had a very peaceful crossing on with tank landing craft, with the Churchill tanks lined up in the bottom, and then drove off the beaches to a large field just outside Bayeux.
Which platoon and company were you with at that time?
I was with number one squadron, and I had what was called a troop of tanks. That's three tanks, similar to a platoon commander. Each young officer had a troop of tanks, three tanks. And
did your troop have a letter?
Have a what?
A letter to distinguish it?
Yes, each tank had a name, and we had a brigade badge, which is on that book I showed you, which is blue, red, blue, the colours of the brigade of guards, and the sword in the middle over on top of that shield.
This is for the 6th Guards Tank Brigade.
And that was called the 6th Guards Tank Brigade.
So you went to this field near Bayeux, you said?
Yes. And that was under canvas. And, of course, the rumble of artillery and the bombers and so on was an everyday affair. And then suddenly things happened and we were aware that we were now going to go into action. It was pretty good stalemate at that time. Caen hadn't been captured, but the bridgehead was completely secure. And the Germans were attempting to counterattack every now and again. The Americans on the right. But the British in their front by Caen held the bulk of the Germans because the Germans were fully aware if we break through in the Caen area, they'd be for it and we'd get over the Seine and pursue them into Germany. So they had their strong forces and their best forces opposite the British. The Americans had a pretty tough time, but they broke out and captured the Cherbourg Peninsula. And at that time, we were involved in the Battle of Comore, which was a breakout on the British front. Right. And we had to get up there as inconspicuously as possible in case the Germans were aware from their occasional flights of fighters that went over very quickly taking photographs. We were on a Comore ridge and our objective was Hill 309, which was about 5 miles to the south. And Hill 309 was on a ridge with wooded on top. And we had a most tremendous artillery preparation. It was done in three phases. The grenadiers with their infantry, which were all 15th Scottish Division, the people we had trained with, had to go down the slope and take a little village in the bottom, about 2 miles away. That was the first phase. Then the Coldstream and the Scots Guards came forward to another road that crossed the middle of the flatter ground. And then the third phase up to Hill 309. And we had our artillery preparation, bomber preparation on Hill 309. And the grenadiers succeeded in their objective and captured quite a lot of prisoners. Had a nasty incident when one of the prisoners who had put his hands up suddenly produced a grenade out of his pocket and killed an officer, grenadier officer. So he didn't last long. Then the Coldstream and the Scots Guards came forward. Scots Guards on our far left, and Coldstream with a direct line for Hill 309. And we got to the second objective all right, over this very difficult country, the Bocage country, small fields with huge banks and trees growing out, small trees, bushes and things growing out of the top. So the tanks were up at a fantastic angle and then balanced over, crashed down the other side, but you never knew what's going to be on the other side, whether it be an 88mm, a Tiger tank or what. And also there were a lot of snipers about. So tank commanders had to be very wary of that and had to get down and close down the top on occasion. But the trouble was that the infantry couldn't keep up with the tanks. And tanks aren't really much good without infantry because of bazooka men and so on, and particularly in this very close-knit country. But anyhow, a decision was made at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon that the tanks would go on to Hill 309 without infantry. It was the first time that's ever happened. And number one squadron, my squadron, was in the lead. And I'm delighted to say I was in the leading, had the leading troop. And we got up on top of Hill 309 before dark, with no infantry. So we had to wait patiently for the infantry to come up. Luckily they did before it was dark, and we could withdraw into harbour, as we called it, because tanks in those days were no good at night, because there were no night sights invented in those days. And so we were safe when the infantry had arrived. And we had taken the whole of the ridge of Hill 309, so that was very satisfactory.
How much enemy opposition had you run into in taking 309?
Surprisingly little after the initial phases, except for snipers, that was the main trouble, and mines. We, with our machine gun beezers, they were in the tanks, we sprayed the trees and occasionally a sniper body would drop out. But from the actual Hill 309 themselves, they had evacuated by the time we got there. They evacuated about an hour before they withdrew. I think the bombing did a lot of good to persuade them to move off.
Did you see many enemy bodies?
Yes, quite a few. But in fact, we had a worse time, not the next day, but the day after. They, from our left flank, they counterattacked. And we could see it forming up, and the infantry, who were dug in by this time, were getting quite nervous. And I was the left-hand troop, and we were in this wooded hill crest, and you other troops to my right couldn't see them at all. So I felt myself in rather a responsible position. And when they got out into the open and were at a sensible range, we let fly with our Sabo ammunition, which was specially issued, 6 rounds per tank, which was said to penetrate the front plate of a tiger or a panther. And I raided the troops to my right for their Sabo ammunition, because I wanted many more rounds than 6 per tank, because they couldn't use them in any case at that time. And you could see it bounce off like ping pong balls, and it never stopped at all. And it was quite a major counterattack, preceded by an artillery barrage. That was the most frightening moment to date in the war, being on the receiving end of artillery stonk, using medium artillery. But then I said to my squadron commander, Major Hambro, could I have command of the armed medium artillery directly under me? They were the other side of Comor Ridge. And he said yes. So I got them on the air, gave them a map reference in clear, to where the counterattack was, and they put down a sighter bang on target, rapid fire, and that did the trick. The Germans then turned turtle and pushed off. And then we had a major shoot with the tanks, because we had the backside of these vehicles and tanks, and there we did penetrate. And the German infantry was scuttling off as fast as they could. There, it sounds rather sordid to say so today, but a lot of bodies were picked up the next day.
Were any of your tanks hit by the German counterattack?
No, none of my three tanks were hit. But a little later on, my tank got hit. And amazingly enough, you hardly believe this, an 88mm solid shot, armour-piercing shot, went through my tank on the left-hand side, through the petrol tank, through the engine, out through the petrol tank, the other side, and it never caught fire. And none of the crew were hurt.